So one of the issues that I've had for a very long time, especially as I've gotten older, is finding a good pair of jeans. When I was young, this wasn't a problem for me, but now that comfort's the number one factor that I look for, I just hadn't found anything that worked as something I could wear all day, every day, until now. Men, if you hate khakis like I do, your time has come. The perfect jean was created by a conglomerate of mostly imperfect men and a couple of extra perfect ladies who set out on a mission to find a jean that we can wear no matter what we're doing. Whether you're lounging on the couch, working outside, salsa dancing, doing yoga poses, or dunking a basketball, this is a pair of jeans that is built for your life. I picked up a pair skeptical at first because I'd been let down so many times before, but I've got to tell you, these jeans slip on like your favorite pair of sweatpants. You know the ones. Once I had my pair, I reached out to the team at Perfect Jean and asked them if I could run an ad on my show. And they were kind enough to offer you, yes, you listening right now, a special 25% off discount code that you can use when you pick up your very own pair. Don't be like me and pay full price. Take advantage and pick up the best pair of jeans you've ever worn right now. Head to theperfectjean.nyc and enter the discount code 25FORFRIENDS at checkout to get 25% off your very own pair of Perfect Jeans. Welcome back. The Disaster Days is the newest book. Thank you so much for hanging out with me again tonight. I really appreciate it. It's been a while.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
Absolutely. Now, I don't know if, like, when we did Chasing Earhart, if I actually told people how I heard about you the very first time, but I actually heard about you thanks to a very dear friend of mine, Carly Casey, who with Walls of Books in Atchison. She got it. I think she got an advance copy of The Last Grand Adventure before it dropped, right? And she goes, we came in there, her and I used to chat, my wife Vanessa and her and I used to chat all the time. We'd come in there and she said, oh, you got to read this book. This is a great book. And it's like, and it's not only Atchison, but it's or Earhart, but it's Atchison and it's Muriel and it's all these different things. And she goes, it's just, you got to check this out. She loaned it to me, I remember. And I read it, I think in one sitting or one and a half sittings or something like that. It was probably the quickest I've ever read a book. It was really, really great. And of course, we'll touch on that a little bit. But now you're back with Disaster Days that came out and you were kind enough to send me a copy of that, which is fantastic. You're super busy. And I'm so happy that you're doing this. And I'm so happy that you're out there writing these novels. This is really incredible.
Thanks so much. And thanks so much for reading them. I actually remember when I got... I don't recall if it was Casey or you who emailed me first.
Yeah.
And I had sent copies to Atchison, you know, hoping that people who are affiliated with the museum or, you know, have local interest would read it. But it was the first time I'd heard from anyone who was, you know, from Atchison who'd read the book. I was so nervous.
Yeah.
I was really terrified that I hadn't done justice to the place. I was really happy after I connected with you and Casey, and your enthusiasm was just the greatest gift going into sharing that book with people.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it was so nicely done. Like when you read novels, you're looking for attention to detail. And I think what you did, I mean, I had only lived there a couple of years at the time and we were putting on the panel. And I think it was 2018. We were putting on the panel and, you know, Carly had mentioned, we got to have you come out. And, you know, they got you to come out and everything. What was, I mean, picking up off like the Chasing Earhart conversation we had, and now that's all behind us, what was that experience like for you coming out to Atchison, signing books, doing a speaking engagement out there? How was that for you?
Yeah, it was really incredible. I think that, you know, anytime you release a book, you're really just hoping to find your audience. And whether it's a large audience or a small one, you just want to find the people where something in the book is going to be meaningful to them, is going to speak to their experience or their interest. And to be candid, it's tough. The children's book market is, you know, there are, I think, 3,000 books a year, new children's book that are released.
Wow.
So it's hard to get attention. It's pretty competitive. And you know, I was nervous with that book about, you know, finding an audience who would appreciate it. And I just looked at being able to come to the festival and, you know, be on Chasing Earhart as just a chance to like really get to connect to the people who I wrote the book for, the people like me who were really interested in Amelia Earhart and who, you know, love history and love really, you know, reading about a sense of place. And, you know, when I read Amelia's own writing, or I think it was her writing and also her sister Muriel's about Atchison, I was like, this sounds like a really cool town. And, you know, I'm from the Midwest originally, not from Kansas, but, you know, my grandmother grew up in Dubuque, Iowa, and it kind of, some of the descriptions reminded me of how she described, like, you know, the bluffs on the Mississippi growing up in Dubuque. And it was sort of like, I wanted to capture that place. And so, you know, I guess I should say that when I do events, I'm like a lot of authors, an introvert. So it can be a bit of a challenge to go and know that you're going to need to, you know, talk to people you don't know and speak in front of a group of people. Like that's, you know, it's something that I kind of have to gear myself up for. But that, you know, for that experience, I was honestly just really excited because it was like, this is every author's dream to go into a room of people who are all as passionate about the thing that you wrote about as you are.
Yeah.
And then to get to share it with them. Like, it was just so cool to have that opportunity.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I got to watch you speak very briefly because I know we're prepping for the panel. And yeah, I mean, just, you know, you really, everybody was sort of really engaged by the book because it, you know, they hadn't really known about the book, and then the book started getting introduced. And then, you know, when you showed up to do the actual, the discussion and actually to talk about the book and to do signings and stuff, people were really excited about reading this novel because so many Earhart books that come out and it's all, you know, it's all historical fact. It's all speculation and theory and everything. And here was something that played on like the passion and the mystery and like, and the relationship between two sisters over time. That was just sort of, it's not something other than Muriel's books themselves. It's not something that's really ever done. So you kind of walked down a path that no one had ever really walked down before. And I think that's what made the book so special. And what made people sort of respond to it as passionately as they did is because this is a book that doesn't care about theory or what happened in the end. This is just something that, hey, this is about, you know, a relationship at the end of the day. And, you know, just like a generational relationship between the two characters. I mean, we won't give away a lot of the stuff people haven't read it yet, but it's a really fantastic read. And we'll definitely have a link to the book in the show notes tonight for sure. And
awesome.
I was kind of interested to see, you know, what you were going to follow up with, you know, after Last Grand Adventure. I know that's probably that was a very big task, I'm sure, to take that on, but Disaster Days, let's talk about that. And what we'll do is we'll do sort of the same thing we did with Chasing Earhart when we had you back on, is we will put a spoiler warning on the front of this episode.
Okay.
Or at least before we jump into the conversation, because we will be talking about some plot details of the Disaster Days. But let's talk about, before we get into the plot and everything, talk about how you started with the story. Like, how did it marinate for you? Where did you come up with the idea? Like, let's start from there.
Yeah. My first three books that I wrote all deal with historical fiction in some way. The Last Grand Adventure is, the whole book is historical fiction. My previous two had sections that were historical fiction, and then, you know, a realistic contemporary story that, you know, kind of wove between the historical fiction. And that's because I'm a history buff myself. I loved all of those topics and researching them and writing about them. But it's a little bit exhausting to write historical fiction. You know, for any book you find, you have to do research. I mean, even if you write about something that's just totally, you know, realistic contemporary fiction, there are still going to be things you're going to need to look up.
Yeah.
But with historical fiction, it's figuring out the historical fact and then figuring out, you know, how people at the time would use language. And, you know, if you want to go get really into it, you know, you can do things like check the weather reports for the days that you're writing about, and, you know, because all of that is in the historical record. So it's a lot of research and a lot of, you know, choices and decisions about when am I going to stick to the fact, when am I going to go with fiction. So after three books like that, I felt like I needed a break. Like I needed to write something else. I was excited to get a new project, but I wanted a break from historical fiction. And it was kind of, I couldn't figure out what I wanted to write. So I was actually one day, it was the summer, I think, of 2015. So it was kind of a long time ago. I was at my day job on my lunch break, and I stumbled upon this article that was trending from the New Yorker magazine called The Really Big One. And it's by this journalist, Catherine Schultz. It's a fantastic article. It's like just the best piece of narrative nonfiction you could read. It's the kind of thing that when you start reading it, even if you have like 15 minutes planned in your day to eat your lunch, you're going to end up taking 35 because you have to finish reading it. You can't stop. So it was that kind of read. And it's basically about this, you know, major fault line that is in the Pacific Northwest, the Cascadia Subduction Zone, which last had a major earthquake about 300 years ago, and I believe 1700, although I'm not looking at my notes right now, so I could be slightly off on that. And that was a magnitude 9, which people didn't really know about until I think it was around the 1970s, you know, mid-century, when people realized the fault zone that the Pacific Northwest, so cities like Seattle and Portland, or along this line, it stretches all the way from Vancouver down to Northern California, and that it's active, that like there will be another quake in this area. And when it happens, it will probably be a magnitude 9. It could be that big.
Yeah.
And you know, the effects it's going to have is going to be really devastating on the area in terms of infrastructure. So the article, the nonfiction article, goes into all of that and describes like, you know, what a nightmare it's going to be if or when this quake happens. And while I was reading it, I was just all of a sudden struck. The journalist mentioned that for certain, you know, suburban areas in the Seattle area where there might be one road or one bridge or even just ferry service that connects people to the rest of the city, it could take them days or possibly weeks to get home after this happens if, you know, a bridge is washed out. And so while I'm reading that, I immediately think, what would happen if a kid was babysitting when that happened? I mean, earthquakes don't always happen when everyone is, you know, safe at home together as a family. And the story was just like sparked from there. So I, you know, I started doing research, and eventually I had time in my schedule to really devote to writing the book. And, you know, that was really how it started. It was, I was inspired by something that I read on my lunch break. I didn't really go looking for another story. And I did end up finding something that I had to do a ton of research for again. Just, it was different this time. It was scientific and on natural disaster preparedness instead of on history.
Yeah. Is that different, or is it sort of like business as usual? I mean, it's just a different, you're just kind of walking into a different area, but I mean, is it versus science and kind of disaster preparedness and maybe the history of disasters versus historical, you know, aviation history and things like that. Is it different in the way you conduct the research, or is it pretty much the same thing, just different category?
Yeah, the research itself was pretty much the same. You know, I read a lot of, you know, nonfiction books on it. I watched documentaries. I even checked out some, you know, like disaster movies to see how other people had portrayed it in a fictional way. So the research itself was more or less the same. I think the freedom came in where once I had kind of like gathered all that information and I sat down to write, I wasn't really beholden to any kind of, you know, historical record or what a real historical figure had done in their life. So I could just freely make things up as long as they were plausible with like the earthquake science.
Yeah.
I did end up having a PhD, a geophysicist. I reached out to her and she read the manuscript. I think it was like a final draft, but it was before copy edits.
Yeah.
Just to make sure that I wasn't portraying any of the science inaccurately, because that was important to me. I didn't want to, you know, use a wrong term or like have something happen in the setting that is like impossible to actually occur.
Yeah, you know, that's interesting. And one thing, I don't think I asked you this last time, or maybe I did, but I think, you know, what I've always found interesting is when you're writing something like historical fiction or scientific fiction, or you're mixing, you know, like a little bit of fact with, you know, which is kind of like a little bit of fantasy or whatever the case is. How do you know? I mean, is it, I'm guessing it's different for every author, for every writer, but how do you know when to take sort of creative liberties on certain aspects and when to stick, okay, here we really have to stick with, you know, scientific fact or as close as we can. And here we can sort of elaborate a little bit more, have a little more fun with it.
Yeah. I mean, that is always the question. And I feel like every project I'm kind of figuring out all over again, or in that like particular case. It was really tough when I writing about Amelia Earhart and her sister. And also in my first book, I write about Alice Roosevelt as a fictional character. It's tough because in order to write good historical fiction, you have to tell a story and you have to make the character interesting and rich. And that involves making a lot of things up because you don't have access to their inner thoughts. I mean, even if you're fortunate enough to have like primary sources, you know, a person's diary or interviews they did, you still don't know what their real emotions were at in these scenes that you're making up. So you have to guess. So for that, I always try to, you know, like stick with what is known about them and not really stray from what is known about their personality or their belief system or whatever. And, you know, to keep it as plausible as possible.
Right.
And then always in an author's note, like making sure that, especially because I write for young readers, that they understand that, you know, this is still fiction, that it's hopefully what people would say is well-researched fiction, but like it's fiction. So I'm making things up. For the disaster days, it was just important that I, you know, especially again, because I'm writing for young readers, I wanted to make sure that I wasn't putting, you know, junk science or, you know, portraying anything incorrectly so they would, you know, end up thinking that something is a fact when it is in fact not. And I think the only thing that's really lingering in there that is sort of me really stretching what is plausible, and this was something that the scientist did point out, is the kids do run during a scene where there is like an active earthquake. They run across the room. She pointed out that at that magnitude, like even just taking two steps in front of you would be really challenging. So someone darting across a room would be really hard. Wow. But she said, you know, in the context of the scene, like, I think you can let this go because it was a pretty dramatic moment. So I did that knowing that I was like straying from what is realistic, but...
Well, with that, I mean, and that's a tease of a scene. Now, at this point, there will be spoilers getting into this point. So if you haven't read The Disaster Days yet, I would urge to stop, pause the recording like we did last time with Chasing Earhart, and come back after you've read it or as you're reading it if you want to go that for some kind of like enhancement. But if for those that are still with us and are still listening to us, let's give everybody the plot. Let's get into The Disaster Days.
So The Disaster Days is the story of Hannah. She is a 13-year-old babysitter. It is only her second time doing an after-school babysitting gig for her next-door neighbors. They live on a fictional island suburb of Seattle called Pelling Island. And while she is taking care of her two younger neighbors, this major magnitude 9 earthquake hits. And, you know, it devastates their house. And I don't want to give away too much, but I think people have, they'll probably guess just from reading the jacket that it takes their parents an indefinite amount of time to get home. And Hannah is left in charge, you know, not only to confront some of her own, you know, fears and feelings of inadequacy, but also to confront some like really significant and challenging hazards that the kids face in the aftermath of this natural disaster.
Okay. So that is a good, that's a good tease. I want to ask you about, and we touched on it a little bit, but I want to ask you about like structure of story and everything. I mean, you kind of talk about, you talked about that a little bit on the first episode when we talked about Last Grand Adventure, but when you have an idea, and I love sort of kind of how you come up with your ideas, it's kind of like a what if question, and then you kind of expand on that. But how does the structure and the story work for you? Like when you sit down to write, is it do you do like any kind of outline for it first? Like do you write just like a loose structure or maybe 20, 30 pages to kind of get warmed up? Like how does that work for you, just kind of portraying all of this or playing this out in your head as far as kind of how you're writing it?
Yeah, I definitely, I'm an outliner. I have some author friends who are not. They just write by the seat of their pants and sit down and go. And I think that's amazing. I'm in awe of them. And that is totally not who I am.
Right.
I need to have a plan. But it kind of varies. For some projects, it's been more defined than others. I always start with an outline where I think I know where the plot is going. And it's kind of like scene by scene. And it changes while I write because I sometimes realize that, you know, I get to a certain point and as I've gotten to know the characters and the setting and everything that's going on, I realize there are different ways for the plot to go. But more or less, I know where we're going to end up by the end.
Yeah.
For The Disaster Days, this was the first project where I had a really in-depth outline when I started. I had written maybe four or five chapters, and then I had an outline that was 30 pages long. Wow. So it was really more like a detailed synopsis where I got into like even, you know, the emotional beats in every chapter and stuff, which made it the most seamless writing process that I've had of any of my books, where I just kind of, I would sit down. I think I wrote it, you know, in the winter time, and I would sit down and have a word count goal that day. And I, you know, would have this like really super detailed outline in front of me and would just, you know, write until I hit my count and then stop for the day. And it was strange because I was used to struggling a little more while writing. And it was really in stark contrast to when I wrote the first draft of The Last Grand Adventure, when the whole process, I was doubting whether I could do what I was trying to do. Yeah. So every day I would sit down and, you know, kind of worry that what I'd written the day before wasn't very good, or that I wouldn't be able to like make this scene come to fruition. And I ended up liking what I ended up with that first draft of that book, to my surprise. But the writing process itself was kind of stressful. And the Disaster Days was just fun. I don't know. It was kind of delightful.
And you can kind of tell in the writing almost. It's pretty interesting kind of like how, I mean, I can certainly understand writing certain things historical fiction wise and how that can be kind of somewhat difficult. You mentioned something about having a word count. For the young aspiring writers out there who want to do what you do and who are working on their own manuscripts and their own stuff, I've talked to so many authors that sometimes sort of beat themselves up if they don't hit a specific goal. Mm-hmm. You know, if they have like short-term goals, hit a long-term goal, et cetera, et cetera. How do you handle that if you ever write yourself into a corner, or if you ever just get frustrated with sort of like, you know, the story, or maybe it's not going where you want? What do you do in that instance? Do you just kind of like, Do you take a breather? Do you kind of divert your attention elsewhere for a little while? How does that work for you personally?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think I'm better at giving advice or perspective on this than I am at actually applying it to my own process. because I tend to be a pretty goal-oriented person. So
yeah.
If my intent was to sit down and write 1,000 words or something and I don't do that, I do feel bad. And there are definitely times where I sit down and I write 1,000 words and they're not very good.
Yeah.
And I'm aware of that while I'm doing it. I think that, you know, I have to constantly remind myself that sometimes it's okay to like make your work that day be to look at your outline again, or to do some necessary research that you need to write the next scene, or to just not hit your word count goal. Yeah. That's something I still need to practice on, but I also think it helps, you know, to remember that, like, even if you write 1,000 words that you're going to end up cutting, sometimes there are, you know, 10 of them or something that really leads to something that's great.
Sure.
So there is, nothing is a waste when you're working on a creative project like that.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%. I've written, been writing a script for an Earhart film for a while, and writing, a transcript of season one of Vanished, which isn't really not me. It's just basically me transcribing everything that was actually said on the show. So it's not really writing in my eyes. I'm not coming up with it. But I feel like there has been times where I'll put in a good amount of work on something, all, you know, for a better part of a day, and I'll just look at it and just think, this is terrible. This is awful. What, you know, I can't even think. I can't imagine what I was thinking, and I almost start from scratch. But I feel like I'm telling myself, like, well, you know, like you said, nothing's a waste. Like, you know, you might have done something. Okay, I got all the bad ideas out of my head. Now let's work on something else, or whatever the case is. So that's kind of, yeah. I mean, that's very powerful, I think.
Yeah. And advice I have to remember all the time that, you know, wiser writers have given me is that, you know, it's important to realize that part of the process is like taking time off and doing things like daydreaming or, you know, watching a related movie that's going to spark some kind of, you know, inspiration for you for a scene. It's so tricky to realize sometimes when your resistance to working on a project is, you know, because you're afraid of it, or, you know, because you just need more time to think or something, and when you are actually just procrastinating and like you're tired and you had you spent the day at your day job and you don't want to do it.
You know, it's interesting hearing you talk about, you know, the actual structure of the story, and kind of it brings to mind the characters. I mean, character development is obviously a big deal. development of those characters is a big deal, along with story. I mean, how do you work with the characters that you create for, you know, for the stories? Is it, do you have those kind of knocked out as well at the beginning? Do you ever find yourself creating a character to fit an aspect of the story or a certain direction you turn later and down, you know, down the actual manuscript or anything like that?
Yeah, I think for the protagonists, I normally have a pretty clear idea of who they are, and who they're going to be in a story. But it's the secondary characters that sometimes they end up playing a bigger role or a smaller role than I expected. Mm. Or maybe sometimes, you know, as you're writing, you get towards the end of a first draft, you realize an aspect of, you know, their personality that you're going to go back in your revisions and make it a lot more prominent, yeah. Kind of stumbling into things. It's funny because, you know, in the earliest days of when I was working on The Last Grand Adventure, I really thought that I was going to write a book where the traveling companion for my main character, the grandmother, is actually Amelia Earhart herself.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was when I was doing more research, I think I'd even written a little, like a little bit to start the book at that point. When I sort of came across more information about her sister Muriel, and then all of a sudden just clicked for me. It's like, no, this is my character. This is the person who I need to have be in the book.
Yeah, that's very, and I'm so glad you did that. Cause yeah, I mean, I agree. It's almost, I don't want to say the easy way out to use Earhart as like the main character, but you know, it's to use Muriel was such a brilliant move, I think, because it's just a different aspect of it. It's a different look. I mean, cause Muriel and Amelia had so different lives. I mean, one was in the spotlight, one was out of the spotlight, you know, but Muriel was a very successful woman in her own right. And I think, to utilize her as sort of, you know, the companion or like, you know, the co-main character of the book is, it was a bold move. And I, speaking of characters and speaking, I mean, I would be sort of remiss if we didn't talk about, you know, we touched on B obviously a little bit in the first time you're on the show with Last Grand Adventure. Now, of course, you have the main character who's Hannah, who you alluded to earlier. What I read some similarities in them.
Yeah.
I think they're both strong young women. You know, they're both, I mean, obviously one is sort of forced into a position by the environment and, you know, the circumstances around her, but, you know, one is sort of on an adventure and it's kind of a different scenario there. But what are some of the, I mean, do you pull any characteristics from B to give to Hannah or anything like that? Or how does that work for you?
Yeah, I think, you know, I think I'm drawn to characters who they I would say they're strong, and both of those two, Hannah and B, I'd say they're both brave, but maybe not in the way that people typically associate with bravery as being, you know, very bold action and a lot of confidence.
Right.
You know, I think it's more of a quiet bravery where they realize that they have an inner fortitude that they didn't know. And the book is, both books in a way are about them kind of like coming into their own sense of self and bravery. And, you know, either B, I think, is a character who starts out being pretty anxious about everything in her life. And over the course of the book, you know, she really starts to embrace adventure. And, you know, whether that's like an actual trip or whether it's just the adventure of like the unknown in life. Mm. And I think Hannah is someone who, you know, she's kind of like struggling with what she perceives as physical limitations in herself and, you know, not really being insecure in some friendships. And, you know, she's thrust into this situation where she realizes like, hey, I'm doing a good job of dealing with this.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's almost like, I don't want to say forced bravery, but you make a good point. It's sort of pushing someone pushing a main character into a situation where they're forced to look within themselves and sort of see something that they never realized that they had, which I think it's in all of us. If we, I think, unfortunately, we're just put in the right situation.
Yeah.
I think it's almost like a fight or flight type deal. I mean, there's a lot of really interesting things that tie into Hannah's character that I think are really, you know, because you can sympathize with that character. You can put yourself in her situation. You know, I mean, I'm from California. I mean, we talked about all the time, what if an earthquake hit and we're in this situation, what would we do? How would we handle it? And so I think that's something that's really, it's really relatable, I think, for this particular character. I mean, not that B was very relatable too, but just different ways, you know, different areas. And I think that's kind of that's one of the grounding factors of the book, of the new book, is this character. She's pretty powerful in my eyes as I'm reading through, you know. Maybe just doesn't know it right off the bat, which is all of us, I think, you know, for the most part. So I want to kind of move on to one of the things that I really love that you do is, there's actually a couple things, but they kind of tie into each other. The discussion questions, you have them on your site. The actual, like, you know, it's these books are obviously, as you mentioned, they're for young readers. They're classroom books. We'll get into sort of the classroom stuff that you've done coming up, but I want to ask you about, like, the discussion questions and how those are structured and kind of why you continue to feel that those are really important. Cause I think spanning discussion on a book is really great. Why do you do that?
Part of it is my day job before I started, writing and then freelance editing full time. I actually worked for a long time on reading textbooks for a large publisher. And so, you know, my job there was to take the literature selections, either, you know, trade books like the ones that I write or classic literature for kids and write discussion questions for them. So I was already in the practice of doing that. Yeah. And I realized how helpful that is for teachers or librarians, educators who might want to use my books in their classrooms to have that available for them. So, you know, it could kind of seamlessly work into their curriculum. But I also think that, you know, even going back to when I was a kid, I remember in my fifth grade classroom, my teacher was Mrs. Gerlach, who I adore. She was wonderful. And she had us read this book, The Westing Game, as a class. It's a really great, middle grade mystery. The author is Ellen Raskin. And as a class, she had us try and solve the mystery while we were reading. So there was like a section of the chalkboard that was devoted to us keeping track of the characters and the plot and like our guesses and stuff. And what I remember of that is every kid in the class was so invested in this reading experience. And like, we would get together before school and huddle and like talk about the book and, you know, explain why we think this theory is what happened in the mystery versus another. And even the kids who weren't really avid readers or who maybe didn't participate as much in class as others were like really into it.
Yeah.
And it was just, that was a really formative experience because I realized that reading is a great thing to do by yourself, but it can also be a community experience.
Right.
And that happens really from discussion. So, you know, I wanted to provide something if people want to have a book club and talk about my books, like to give them some stuff to chew on.
Yeah, absolutely. And I highly recommend it. And again, we'll have those in the show notes. It's really great because it's an enhancement for the book. And it's really one of those things that, you know, yeah, like book clubs. I mean, I feel like those are not really as big as they used to be, but they should be. You know, I think it's really great to sort of discuss things. And it's almost like a young reader's version of the Amelia Earhart case. You got people like looking at all this data and they're giving their theories and their reasons why they think this is what happened and this is what they were thinking. And I mean, it's really no different. It's just, it's in book form. And I think it's really great. And one of the other things is we talked about it is, we touched on it a little bit, is the classroom visits. You do some of those. I actually do a lot of those. Talk about how important you feel that is to kind of have, you know, yourself come into a class either via, you know, Skype or Zoom or something, or in person even, and to kind of talk with readers, get your audience's direct feedback on some of the stuff you write.
School visits are, they're really the most delightful part of this job. You know, the publishing industry can be challenging to work in. Every author has a lot of ups and downs. The thing that is constant is just how amazing it feels to get to go spend some time, you know, in person or on Skype or whatever, with young readers and talk to them about creating books and to just see their excitement. And I know when I was a kid, my mom was a language arts teacher, and she took me to an author talk when I think I was 13, where it was actually my favorite author who was speaking. And it was the first time I had met someone who had written a book. And it was, I remember just being kind of blown away and thinking like, this is a job you can do when you grow up. This is something that, you know, authors are not magicians, even though it seems like creating a story is a form of magic, but like they're people like anyone else who work really hard at, you know, producing a story. Yeah. And I think it's powerful for kids to, you know, get to talk to people who work in creative fields and realize that like, this is a job path that you can take. So it's really cool to talk to them. I went to one school visit this this fall, and the kids had actually made like a paper cutout of one of my characters. And that was like my jaw dropped.
Yeah.
And I could not believe it. Like, I was just kind of in awe. Like, I felt so fortunate to get to have that experience, to like share something with readers and then to have their enthusiasm come back to me. I mean, it was like such a gift.
Yeah. That's power you can't buy. It really is. I remember the first time I met Brad Meltzer, I wept internally. He's been my hero for the longest time, and we got to work with him on Chasing Earhart and record with him for the documentary. And it was just, you know, authors are, there's something special about authors. There really is, because they do something, they, you know, they create from scratch, and it's just a beautiful thing. And people that write novels, and like what you do, obviously, you know, historical fiction is just, it's so much fun. And it's just, I think it breathes life into, you know, history, science, mathematics, whatever is in that, you know, that book, whatever is kind of like almost a hidden foundation is really, it's a great thing. And I think it's people need to keep doing it, because I think it gets the word out there. It gets people to discuss, gets people to learn things that they didn't really necessarily know they could ever do or ever wanted to do, they can do through the books, which I think is great.
Yeah.
Okay. So a couple of quick questions before we sort of wrap up tonight. I wanted to ask you, I don't think I asked you this last time. What were your favorite novels? What were your favorite novels growing up?
Oh, great question. I really loved, there was an author, Anne Rinaldi, and she wrote a ton of historical fiction novels when I was a kid, you know, about stuff like the Salem witch trials and the Boston Tea Party. And I just like read them compulsively. And I think that's really where some of my interest in like writing about real history and historical figures started. And she would always do, you know, I think usually her main character would not be, you know, the actual historical figure. Like it would be someone who lived in Paul Revere's house, you know, was maybe a maid's daughter or something, would kind of like be there witnessing the history. So clearly that sparked something in me, because I went back to that kind of thing with three of my books. I also really loved Hatchet by Gary Paulsen. And, you know, books like that and Island of the Blue Dolphins and My Side of the Mountain. And Hatchet in particular, I loved because, if for people who aren't familiar, it's this classic where a boy is taking a plane, I think, to visit his father, who's in the remote, like, Canadian wilderness. And the pilot has an issue. The plane goes down, and the boy ends up being stranded in the wilderness by himself and having to survive. And, you know, so when I was thinking about writing The Disaster Days, I kind of wanted it to be there to be like a bit of an echo of Hatchet in it, in terms of the same, you know, a kid having to be really self-sufficient and having a survivalist aspect. Because when I read that I remember reading that as a young person, and as you're turning the pages, you're thinking like, well, what would I do in this situation? Like, would I eat the berries? Like, would I have figured out how to, you know, like rub the twigs together to start fire or find a flint and like all of that stuff. And it was really kind of exciting to, as a reading experience. So, you know, clearly that also had a big impact on me.
Yeah. You can tell the influences. Yeah.
Yeah.
Definitely. Yeah. I mean, I remember when I was a kid, I mean, Nancy Drew, that was such a big deal. I mean, it's like, and that Nancy Drew, the character is actually making some sort of a comeback now. They had the film that just came out, and then they have like a new show, like it's like a horror show or something with Nancy Drew. Have you heard of that or seen that yet?
Yes, I have heard of it. I have not checked it out. I've been meaning to, because I was a huge Nancy Drew fan myself.
Yeah.
I had all of the books with like the yellow spine, I think. The
yeah.
That I had.
Yeah.
And I remember my best friend at the time, we would go to the school library and check them out, and she'd be like, oh, that's number 37. That one is really scary. Like, you're going to have, you can't read it after dark.
Yeah.
And so we would sort of be trying to like psych each other out.
Yeah. 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 I mean, I guess there always was sort of like this underlying element of horror in the Nancy Drew stuff. And I guess they're playing that up now. So I'll have to check that out. Now, the last thing I wanted to ask you, before we sort of get into the next chapter in all your books that are coming out. But these books, to me, they scream like film. Has anybody talked to you about turning any of these books into film, whether it's like a theatrical release or something like that? Because it just screams film when you're reading.
Yeah, I would love to see my books, you know, turn into film or TV or, you know, some kind of like other kind of performance medium. Yeah. When Audrey Met Alice did have a film option at one point, it's still kind of in the sort of development whatever stage. Yeah. But yeah, that's absolutely, I think most writers I know were all kind of like, oh please, wouldn't it be great to become like a Netflix movie or, you know, series, because there's so much content that's being produced now. But
yeah well, we need original content, and a lot of and I mean, all your books, it's original content, and it sort of takes little pieces that are, you know, that are popular with certain aspects, but it's all original content, which I think is really great. And we need more of that. Now you have another book coming out that's actually coming out. We talked about it a little bit offline. Tell everybody as much as you can about the next book that's coming out this year.
Sure. So I have another book that's coming out this October. I believe the publication date is October 6th, 2020, and it's called Alone in the Woods. It is another survival story. This time it's about two former best friends who are forced to work together to stay alive after they get dangerously lost in a remote national forest.
Wow.
The forest is the Nicolet National Forest. It's in northern Wisconsin.
I like it. I can't wait. Will you come back on when that comes out so we can talk
I'd
about
that
to. One as
well? I'd love to. Yeah.
Absolutely. Now, before we let you go tonight, plug your website. Let's plug some of the books. Obviously, Disaster Days, Last Grand Adventure, Alone in the Woods is coming out. We just touched on it. Plug away, please.
Okay. Yeah. My website is RebeccaBarons.com. There's information about all my books there, which are When Audrey Met Alice. In brief, that is a fictional first daughter today finds Alice Roosevelt's diary and then is inspired to recreate some of her shenanigans in the White House. The Summer of Lost and Found, which is about a girl who is spending her summer on Roanoke Island in North Carolina and decides to try and figure out the mystery of the lost colony of Roanoke. The Last Grand Adventure, which is my Amelia Earhart story about Bee and Pidge, who go on this cross-country planes, trains, automobiles road trip to try and find Amelia Earhart. The Disaster Days, which is my babysitting disaster story, so during the Magnitude 9 earthquake. And Alone in the Woods, which will be about, you know, kind of frenemies in the woods. As a friend in the industry, when I was telling her about the book, back when I was starting to write it, she said, so basically you're writing a middle grade book that is an episode of Naked and Afraid. And I was like, that's actually a very apt description. So,
yeah, there you go. Okay, yeah. Descriptions for all four books that are out now, one coming out this year. I couldn't have said it better myself. Rebecca, this has been a pleasure. Thank you so much for coming back on and hanging out with me tonight. I really appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me, Chris.
If you made it all the way through our conversation tonight, I want to thank you for hanging out with me and my friends. We hope you've enjoyed the show. Please visit us on social media as we post each new conversation as they air, news, show information, and much more. Go to facebook.com/meandmyfriendspod. On Twitter, you can search the handle MeMyFriendsPod. And on Instagram, you can find us by searching the handle @MeAndMyFriendsPod. If you enjoyed our conversation tonight, please do me a favor and head to iTunes to rate us and leave us a review. As a brand new podcast, we need all the help we can get, and your time is truly appreciated. Me and My Friends is produced by Vanessa Williamson and edited by me, Chris Williamson. This episode of the podcast featured the original song Dreams by producer Redeman. The opinions on Me and My Friends are those of the individual guests and may not reflect those of Chris Evan Films Incorporated. Chris Evan Films Incorporated is not affiliated with the films or clips referred to herein. Any audio clips used in this podcast are the intellectual property of their respective copyright holders. They are included here for the purposes of education and entertainment, and no infringement is ever intended. Me and My Friends is an exclusive trademark of Chris Evan Films Incorporated and may not be used without the express written consent of Chris Evan Films Incorporated. All rights reserved. Me and My Friends is a Chris Evan Films production, copyright 2020, all rights reserved.